Among many glorious services, Mataji was a principal at Gurukul for 27 years. She is also an author of many books and has written innumerable articles in Back to Godhead magazine, traveling around the world giving seminars, lectures, and is doing currently amazing service, inspiring all as Vaishnavis like us. Thank you so much, Mataji.
So this is 19th of February 2021, ladies meeting, and this is going to be open questions and answers, right?
Yes.
And you're supposed to write them down. Do you have questions written down?
Yes.
Oh, super.
Do they have a
course?
Is this our magic box?
Yeah.
Are you the magic box keeper?
Someone wants, you need some more time?
We just pull one out at random? There's not very many questions here. Why is Krishna mentioning about Vishnu when he is Supreme God himself? He says in initial chapters about Vishnu. Again, in the middle chapters, he says he is Krishna Supreme God. He is, again comes back to surrendering Vishnu in later chapters too. How surrendering to Vishnu is different from surrendering to Krishna. It isn't. Vishnu and Krishna are the same person. You could think like, just like if somebody has a job, so they don't behave at the work exactly the way they behave at home, but they're the same person. So Vishnu is more like Krishna in his royal aspect. But sometimes we speak about ourselves in the third person. You might say to your children, you know, you have to listen to your mother. You are the mother, but you might say like that. Yes? Mm-hmm. The father might say to the children, it's important to respect your father. Because then you're talking about a principle. So sometimes Krishna just says, surrender to me, and other times he's saying, you have to surrender to God. Mm-hmm. It's a principle to surrender to God. Sometimes he talks to Arjuna about the super soul, surrender to him utterly. Vishnu and Krishna are saying they're just in a different mood. You know, when we are in a different mood, we have different clothes. Like if we're going to be working outside planting flowers, we're not going to wear the same clothes we wear to a wedding. And we get in a different mood, right? If you're just with your close friends, you may be joking. Sometimes we even insult our friends as a joke, yes? But that's different from public behavior. So the Lord, in his different moods, he has different, not just dress, but he has a different form even. I was looking at Sadhguruji and I'm thinking, so there's the Lord as a Brahmana, as a Kshatriya, and as a Vaishya. Different mood. So, different dress, different form. It's a very good question. Okay, why we all are here and why Lord has made us to suffer? Oh, this is the big question everybody has. And there's to suffer all over. We are suffering all over. Okay? We are taking janma again, janma. Uh-huh. Why Lord is putting us in this world and we all keep suffering? That's everybody's question. This is the one question that the atheists say religious people cannot answer. It's very easy to prove that there must be a God. That's actually a very easy thing to prove. If we think something very simple like this chair, or the curtain, that's even more simple. The curtains on the window, they're a very simple thing, but a child could not make that, a young child, 2-year-old child could not make that. It requires some, and certainly an animal couldn't do it, even a monkey or something could not make that. It requires some intelligence and a person. And that's just a design of flowers. So, of course, the real flower that can reproduce must require intelligence. There's so many proofs of the existence of God. But the people ask, if there's a God, why is there so much suffering? So, of course, we learned, I mean, it's not only in the Vedas, but even in the Bible, Jesus talks about that the son of a rich man, he says, I want to leave and make my own way. I don't want to listen to you anymore. So this is the description everywhere that we have chosen to rebel. That is it's our choice. It's not Krishna's choice. It's not his desire. I'm sure that all of us know some good parents who have a bad child. We all know of somebody like that. Good parents, good family, and the child goes bad. That's not the desire of the parents. The good parents do everything they can to help the child become responsible, but I mean, I know one family, they had twin boys, and both the boys got initiated, but one of the boys is very first class. He heads up a whole sangha of devotees. He knows the shastra very well. His family is very responsible. And the other one, he's had this girlfriend, that girlfriend, involved with marijuana, and just irresponsible, twin boys. So we all know something like that. So we are rebels. I think it's very difficult for us to understand this because we think that we're very good. We all look at ourselves and think, I am a good person. I don't do anything wrong. Or if I do something wrong, oh, thank you. If I do something wrong, it's something very small. We think I only make very small mistakes. And all my mistakes are well-intentioned. That's how we think about ourselves. You think, I have a good heart, I have good intentions, I don't want to hurt anybody. And sometimes I make mistakes. So I always wonder whether or not to tell people this, because nobody told me this when I started Krishna Consciousness. But one of the things that will happen to you if you seriously take up a spiritual path, any genuine spiritual path, I don't care what it is, it doesn't have to be Krishna Consciousness. In any genuine spiritual path, you will see your real heart. We will start to see the truth. Like Lord Chaitanya in the Shikshasana, he says, Cheto Darpanam Marjana. Darpanam is a mirror. The dirt is clean from the mirror. One sees oneself accurately. And what we see when we see ourselves is a very strange kind of contradiction. We will see that we are a spiritual being, and we are actually, truly, really, completely 100% good. But we have chosen to associate ourselves with the material energy and become acting as if we are evil. So we see this, that I'm not actually evil, I'm not really evil. This sense I have, that we all have, that I'm good, it's because we are good. But when we're materially conditioned, we're not good. At all. So I used to be a teacher of children and teenagers, and the teenagers I used to sometimes take to the courthouse as part of their education in government. And I saw many different trials with my students. And I noticed that many of the people who were committing crimes when they were intoxicated on something, cocaine or alcohol or something. So you may be a good person, but if you're drinking alcohol, if you're taking cocaine, you will do evil things under the influence of that intoxicant. But the person chooses to take the intoxicant. The government does not say, oh, you were under the influence of cocaine, therefore you are excused from this murder. They don't say that. Why? Because the person chose to take the cocaine. So that's not their natural state. Their natural state is healthy and sane. So we as the soul, our natural state is completely pure goodness. But we choose to take this intoxication of illusion. And under the influence of illusion, everything we do is evil. More or less. It may be some great evil, like somebody who kills 1,000 people and burns down buildings, rapes, or it may be little evil that we are using other people for our own purposes. We see others as simply a means to satisfy our own desires. And that is the reality for every single one of us. We don't like to admit it. It's very awkward because we do have this sense that I'm pure soul. And so it's very embarrassing. Just like a person, you know, they wake up in the morning after being drunk the night before and they're very embarrassed. Mm. What was I doing when I was drunk? Oh, you were singing in the streets. So they're very embarrassed. So we're embarrassed by this. It's hard for us to see it. But we have to see it. We have to see it because we have to throw it off. Just like the alcoholic, the drug addict, they have to understand, I am an alcoholic. So Krishna's mercy, at least in this life, I have never been addicted to anything. But what I'm told is that it's most alcoholics, they don't know that they're alcoholics. I'm sure you've heard this. They don't even understand. And one day they understand, you know, I'm an alcoholic. And I've ruined my life, and I've hurt people. And then they can get help. Only then. As long as they think, oh, I'm just drinking a little bit, it's really under control, and they cannot be helped. So we also have to be able to see. And this will happen if you chant Hare Krishna and you read the Bhagavatam and you worship Krishna. It will happen. You will see this. And it is quite unpleasant. As I said, nobody told me this when I started taking up Krishna consciousness. But it's quite unpleasant. One sees, oh, I am a Maya addict. I am a Maya-holic. And I am hurting myself. Constantly. I am making myself suffer. You know, and when the drug addict or the alcoholic goes for treatment, the treatment is also painful. It's painful. Is that the fault of the doctor? So this process of seeing that I have become, thinking I'm going to find my pleasure in illusion, it's embarrassing, it's difficult. So we are responsible. Only we are responsible. Now, even in the material world, I mean, Krishna says, Abrahma Bhuvanaloka Punarvartin Arjuna. He says that there's suffering everywhere in the world. He says, Dukalayama Shasvatam Asukam Anicca. But there's a lot of the material world where the suffering is very small. You know, on the higher planets, the planets of Indra, the planets of the Prajapatis, the Rishis, there's not really very much suffering like we think of it here. There's just not. You know, the people there live millions and millions and millions of years, and they're always young, and everyone's beautiful, and they're healthy and strong. people are basically peaceful. So if one follows the laws of the universe, even in the material world, one doesn't suffer so much. It's not like Krishna is just saying, go suffer. Krishna will even give the living entities material happiness if they earn that through their karma. And Krishna wants us to be in Vaikuntha, where there's no suffering at all. That's what he wants. He doesn't want us to stay in illusion. Even in this life, if we get free of illusion, we will not be, we will not experience the suffering of suffering. So that's Krishna's desire. He put us in illusion only because we insist on it. But that's a hard thing to see. It's a very difficult thing to see. We cannot imagine that I have wanted to suffer. We just think that is crazy. I'm not a crazy person. Why would I want to suffer? But we have an experience of this all the time. That we do things that we know will cause us to suffer, and we do them anyway. Am I correct? We do it all the time. We eat things we know will make us feel bad. We eat too much. Or we eat the wrong thing, and we know. If I eat this, I will not be happy. And we eat it anyway. We say things that we know will not be good. We get angry, or we're tired, or we're frustrated. And we say something, often to people that we love. To our children, to our husband, to our parents maybe. To people at work. And we know, I shouldn't say this. And we know, if I say this thing, I will suffer. And we say it anyway. We have something to get done, and instead we do everything else. We clean the house that is already clean. We fold the laundry that's already folded. And then we have to hurry up and do the important thing at the last minute, and we're suffering. Yes? So we are constantly doing things that we know will make us suffer. And yet we are so surprised that overall I am causing my own suffering. So that is not Krishna's fault. I always give the example, there's a door and there's a wall. So the wall does not exist to give pain. That is not the purpose of the wall. The purpose of the wall is to hold up the building. The architect who designed the building, the builders, the painters, they did not say, let me put a wall here to cause people pain. But if you walk into the wall, you will feel pain. If instead of, or you try to walk out the window, if you try to get out the room, out of the room by going through the wall or going through the window, you will suffer. But the window and the wall is not designed for suffering. So all of our suffering is like that. We don't see it clearly. When we're in Maya, we don't, just like the alcoholic, doesn't actually, they don't understand. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm causing my own suffering. They really don't understand. So we are in a very similar situation. We don't understand. I am walking into walls. And that's why I'm suffering. And it's not Krishna's fault at all. It's not like Krishna's designed the world, even though he says Dukalaya. It's not like Krishna said, oh, I'm going to make a suffering place. It's that as soon as we have a mood that I want to be independent from God, that is false. I cannot be independent from God. And if we try to do something that is not truth, we will suffer. Exactly like if you try to walk through something that is not designed to be walked through. Or if instead of drinking the water, if I try to eat the cup. It's false. The cup is not meant for that. It's false. So I am not meant to be a rebel and independent of God. I'm not meant for that. And so when I try to do that, it doesn't work. And I suffer. But again, it's not that Krishna's designed it to make me suffer. Like no one has designed this cup to make me suffer. That's not. Does that make sense? Yeah? If I take this flower and actually put it up my nose, then you'll have to take me to the hospital. But that's my fault. It's not the fault of the flower.
Yeah.
Is that clear? Yes. But Krishna wants us to be happy. Even materially, Krishna would like us to be happy. You know, in the other ages of the earth, people were generally happy. In the other ages of the earth, there was clean air, clean water, clean food. You didn't have to work so hard to live. The fruit was just growing on the trees. The jewels were just coming out of the ground. You didn't need to have deep mines. The weather was always pleasant, never too hot. You didn't need air conditioning. There were hardly any deserts. Even the scientists say that. These places were not a desert thousands of years ago. They have found, even in Siberia, it used to be subtropical. Can you please explain how to be a good wife to a non-devotee husband and how to raise Krishna-conscious children in this case? Well, I always have a difficulty talking about something where I don't have any direct experience. So I married a devotee. He was already a devotee when I married him. So I was very fortunate that both of us had very similar ideas about how to raise the children in Krishna consciousness. We wanted our children to go to devotee schools. We brought our children every morning to Mangalartik at the temple. We lived right next to a temple. You know, we only ate devotee cooked prasadam. We didn't have a television in our house. So, you know, I was very fortunate in that way. I mean, I have misfortune in other ways. Please don't think I have only fortune in my life, materially. That would not be accurate. But I really don't know. The best I could do would be to talk about other people's experiences. And, you know, if the husband is at least open and favorable, then it's not so hard. If the husband is opposed, it can be very difficult. And sometimes the other person is opposed. Like, openly, they say they're okay, but actually they're opposed. So I know of some families like that where... And it can be the wife also, it can be the other way.
Yes.
You know, where they say, yeah, you know, it's all right to be Krishna conscious, but every time there's a chance to go to some meeting, they have something else that's more important. You know, it's... They're always pushing the other way. Now, I did do some research on what were the main factors in helping kids to become devotees. And I have several seminars, actually I have three different seminars about raising children, so I don't have time to give any of them tonight. But they're all recorded. So one of them is called The Four Keys, and that's on YouTube. There's a very nice recording from Melbourne. We have a professional videographer associated with the Melbourne Temple, and he makes very nice videos. So it's interesting because usually that class is an hour, but in Melbourne it was only a half an hour, but everybody has watched that one because the video is so good, because it was professionally made. So that's Four Keys. And then I have another one, Parenting According to the Gita. There may be a video of that, but for sure there's an audio. For sure. And then there's another one I give, The Principles of Gurukula from Srila Prabhupada. And I gave that one first in Mayapur several years ago, during this time, around this time. That's definitely on ISKCON Desire Tree. I don't know if there's a video of it. I gave that class again very recently. I guess it was in 2018, October, in Pune. The Principles of Gurukula. So you can find those. And then you do as much of those as you can in the situation that you have. And remember that it's not it's not just chance that a child has the parents that they have. And no parents are perfect. Even if you had a devotee husband, there might be some other problem. You know, if you're honest, you'll realize you're not a perfect mother. And if you're honest. And every child has exactly the right circumstances for them. But do what you can. And there's probably a lot you can do. So instead of thinking about what you can't do, think of what you can do. One thing for sure that is not a good idea is for your child to see that because of your Krishna consciousness, you're always critical of your husband, or you're always critical of your child. And it's not a very good idea for children to see that Krishna consciousness is just a list of rules. So if you and your husband are always fighting about rules, and the Krishna consciousness is just a list of rules, that will turn the child away from Krishna consciousness instead of towards it. So that, I've seen that even if both parents are devotees, because sometimes when both parents are devotees, one is more strict than the other. That is also very common. And if the one who's more strict, if they're always criticizing, then to the child, the parent who is not so strict, they are more fun. And they are more pleasant. And the child's going to think, oh, Krishna consciousness makes you mean. You understand? I find it very difficult to control my anger. I get angry with my daughter when she doesn't listen to me. Can you guide me? I'm a terrible mother. Okay, well, first of all, labeling yourself as a terrible mother is probably not a very good idea. I mean, if you really, 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 really are a terrible mother, you probably need to go get some kind of counseling or therapy. If you're actually a terrible mother, you know, if you're abusing your child, get yourself into some sort of therapy. But if you're just having a real problem with anger and you're not being abusive, then one of the things you want to do is not put a label on yourself. Generally, when people are very angry with others, they're also very angry at themselves. And then we're angry at ourselves for being angry. And we're angry at the fact that we're angry that we're angry. So there's many, many ways to deal with this. First of all, everybody gets angry sometimes. If you're alive, you're going to get angry sometimes. Just what it is. Prabhupada writes about this in the purport to Bhagavad Gita 14:22-25. As long as we have a material body, we're going to be affected by the modes of nature, our body and mind. Anger will arise in the body. Fear will arise in the body. Lust will arise in the body. Envy will arise in the body. All these emotions will arise in the body from time to time. Do not think that spiritual life means that these things will stop arising in the body. The question is to see it as not me. We have all fasted, and when we are fasting, hunger arises in the body. And we see that, no, today I'm fasting. And then after a while, the feeling of hunger goes away. Yes? You have to tolerate it for a while. You know, I've done like a, you know, near jhana, no food, no water, no sleep. And I'd find like 11 in the morning, I'd start to feel hunger. By 12:30, it would be gone. And then like 2:33 in the afternoon, I would feel thirst. By like 5 o'clock, it would be gone. And then like in the 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, I would feel very tired. By 4 or 5 o'clock, it would be gone. So these things, they're, we see that they're not me. That's the same with anger. It can really help to understand why we get angry. This is being angry at a child. we get angry as a gift from God to defend ourself, what we think is ourself, our body and mind, when our mind becomes convinced that there's a threat. This is necessary. The material body we have is very fragile. It can be damaged or killed very easily. My grandson-in-law is in the military, and when he was going through his military training, it's very harsh military training. And one of the leaders, you know what his rank was, he told Sri Arjuna, my grandson-in-law, he said, we give this very harsh training because you may have to kill another human being in a war. And he said, killing another human being physically is very easy because the body is very fragile. It's very easy to destroy the body. That's not difficult. But psychologically, it's very difficult. Psychologically, to kill another human being is very difficult. So we have to give this heavy training. But we all know that for our body to die, it's extremely easy. We just have to fall down somewhere. We just have to trip and fall. Get hit by a car. Get some little disease. When I was traveling here, everybody had these masks on.
Yeah.
So we are constantly, we're designed by God to be constantly looking through our environment for a threat. Constantly. We're always scanning our environment for any kind of a threat. Like if you're outside, you have to be, is there a snake? Is there a dog? And in older times, you know, is there a tiger? But we are not only threatened by snakes and dogs and sharp rocks, but we are social creatures. It's very difficult for us to live alone. We're herd animals. We live in a group. And if we don't have acceptance in a group, our survival is also threatened. Now, in a group, as a herd animal, we have status. Like in cows, with cows, you know there's a chief cow? Did you know that? There's one cow always will go eat first. There's an order.
Yeah.
In most herd animals, there's some kind of an order. And the higher up you are in the order, the more food you get, the more protection you get.
Yeah.
Yes, and some animals, the more mates you get. And so we also have wired into our biology that we want to be accepted by a group. Otherwise, it's hard to live. It's hard to even have food and shelter. If we had to make our own house, our own clothing, our own food, everything ourselves, it's possible, but it's very difficult. So we want to be accepted by a group, and this is very important when it comes to anger and our children. We want to have a certain status. The higher status we have, the better. This is for our survival. And this is why we become angry when we are insulted, when we are disrespected. And this is especially why we become angry at our children. When our children are disrespectful or disobedient or difficult, our animal brain interprets this that our status is threatened. And any threat to status is frightening to us. Now, if we're being threatened and we have to protect ourselves, anger is very useful. What we call anger releases all these chemicals into the body that give us the strength to fight or to run away or to hide. That's what it's for. It's there as a biological animal type of protection. So understanding this is very helpful, because we can understand if someone insults me or is disrespectful, or even if I just believe that they are. The child may not be disrespectful. The child may be just tired or hungry or upset with something at school or something else. But if I believe that my child is disrespectful, there's something on a biological level where the brain says, danger, danger, danger. You're going to lose your status. And if you don't have enough status, you won't have any food. You'll be the last cow. You have to fight. You have to fight to maintain your status. Does this make sense to everybody? Mm-hmm. This is the biological reality of anger. I will guarantee you that most of the time, when we think we are angry for a good reason, the only good reason is that we are feeling on some biological level that we are threatened. We often will say, I am angry because I care about raising my child nicely, or I'm angry because there's this injustice in the world, or, you know, this philosophical problem and this social problem. And I will tell you very honestly that that is usually not actually what is going on. What's going on is a basic mechanism of defending. So when we become aware that this, and it's a good thing, it's not a bad thing. Just like in your house, you may have a smoke alarm. Do any of you have a smoke alarm in your house?
Yes.
And sometimes when you make chapatis, it goes off, yeah? The smoke alarm is a good thing. You want a smoke alarm. You want that if there's a fire at night when you're sleeping, the smoke alarm will wake you up. But when you make chapatis, it also goes. Yeah? And you have to know this is going for a chapati, not for a fire. So one should know that if my child is disrespectful, I'm not going to lose my food. I'm not going to lose my house. Also, when our children are disrespectful around other people, we fear a loss of status.
Yeah.
That other people will think I'm a terrible mother, and then other people won't respect me. And then I'll lose my access to resources in my community. And a lot of why we want our children to behave is for that reason. Ah! But when you understand this, then we don't have to take it so seriously. No, I'm not going to die if my child is disrespectful. Then we can train the child for the sake of the child, instead of out of our own fear. If we're like, okay, this is a biological reaction. That's all it is. I don't have to respond to it. I don't have to be the slave of my biology. I can say, it's a chapati. Is it a fire or is it a chapati? It's a chapati. I can turn off the alarm. Don't need a ringing alarm. Okay, now let's see what's going on. And now let me deal with the child, not out of my fear, but out of love for the child. The child has to be corrected for the child's sake. But most likely, we will not do this perfectly all the time. Especially if we are very tired, if we are sick, if we are in some kind of physical pain, if we are already having some other problem in our life, if we just had a big fight with our husband that morning, and then the child is insubordinate, we may not be able to have the capacity. And we know even in the Shastra, Maharaj Parikit got angry at a sage when he was hungry and tired and thirsty. So that doesn't mean he was a terrible king. And if we are very hard on ourselves, we will also be very hard on everybody else. Yeah. another way to deal with being too angry with other people is to learn how to be kind to yourself. We see this all the time. The people who are very harsh with others are also very harsh with themselves. And it damages ourselves. There's a lot of evidence that people with like chronic diseases and chronic pain are often perfectionists who are always pushing themselves past their capacity to function. There's a lot of very solid medical evidence of that. So we're not going to be perfect on that level in this world, in this body. We're not aiming for that. It's not possible. We are aiming to be at the point where we no longer identify with the anger that happens in our body from time to time. That we can step back and say, this is in the body. It's not me, soul. And it's about survival of the body. But I'm not this body. So even if I am in physical danger or social danger, I'm not this body. And I don't have to be the servant of anger to protect something that I'm not anyway. That's what we're trying to do. But we're not going to get to a point that these things don't come into me. And until we're very, very advanced, sometimes we will be overwhelmed by them. We just will. Even very, 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 very advanced devotees who are not 100% pure are sometimes overwhelmed by these things. It's all over the Shastra. Am I correct?
Yes.
It's all over the Shastra. The great yogi Vishwamitra, he got overwhelmed by lust, then he got overwhelmed by anger. Yes? And believe me, he was much better at controlling his senses than probably any of us. And still, all these things are there. So we forgive ourselves, we apologize, and we get up and go on. But if you're actually a terrible mother and you're actually abusing your kid, please go get help. Okay. Similar. How to deal with teenagers, especially when they fed up of a lot of restrictions at home, do not get the food they want from home. In general, dealing with kids with just a lot of restrictions is not effective. Again, I talk about this in the Four Keys. So that's usually not effective, to just simply have restrictions. You don't want your kids to see Krishna consciousness means a lot of restrictions and rules. I'm not saying you shouldn't have restrictions and rules, but if that's all your children see of Krishna consciousness, they're going to rebel against it. We're all like that. Aren't all of us like that? Prabhupada says the need of the soul is freedom. So if we present Krishna consciousness as a way to be less free rather than more free, it's a question of how you package things. Teenagers will work very hard and have very tight restrictions for things they want to achieve. A teenager will play a video game for hours and 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 days and days and days and days and practice and practice and practice and practice and practice. And there's so many rules and restrictions in the video game. The computer has rules, the game has rules. They don't mind because it's part of what they want to achieve. But nobody likes just rules for rules. Do you like just rules for rules? Someone says to any of us, okay, Krishna consciousness means can't do this, can't do this, can't do this. Sometimes people preach like that. And inside you're thinking, yeah. It's not attractive at all. Who is more important, Krishna or husband? Oh, come on. Really, seriously? Come on, all of you guys. I hope so. Why do we have a husband? So we have a husband because as a conditioned soul, it's very difficult to live without the opposite sex for most people. It's very difficult for a man to live without a woman or a woman without a man. And if we don't have a proper husband, we'll be in some improper relationship. That's generally the case for most people. Some people are naturally renounced, but most people cannot live like that for a long time and be a balanced person. We need that to be balanced. And we serve our husband not usually just because our husband is some great personality, but because Krishna wants us to serve the husband for peace and sanity in society. Again, if you're honest, you're not asking your children to obey you because you're always right. If you're honest. Is anyone here always right? Never make a mistake. Or you're never just grumpy and tired and... But you still want your children to be respectful. Why? Because otherwise it's chaos. So we're respecting a husband to have a peaceful society to please Krishna. We're not really trying to please our husband, we're really trying to please Krishna. If you work in a company, you're trying to please the customer so you can please your boss, not really so you can please the customer. The boss is paying you. Who's more important, the customer or the boss? The boss is much more important. But the boss wants you to please the customer. So to please the boss, you please the customer. You understand? And if the customer is not pleased, but you did everything right, the boss will say it's okay. Yes?
Yeah.
If the customer is unreasonable, but you did your job, the boss will say that's okay. And sometimes they record the conversations or something. So if your husband's not always pleased, but you're trying to please your husband to make Krishna happy, then it's okay. You'll never be able to please your husband 24/7. Just like you won't be pleased by your husband 24/7 either. What to do if he is not as enthusiastic as me? It seems he's busy and fulfilling worldly duty only. It pulls me back, but what to do in such situations? Again, it's hard for me to speak about this from my personal life. So I can only talk about this from what I've seen with other people. Please just remember that everybody has something in life that makes Krishna consciousness difficult. Or that makes life difficult. And we usually think, if I could just fix this one thing. But if you fix that one thing, you know what? You would find something else. When I was a teacher, I noticed I always had a child in every class that was the worst behaved. Has to be. Not all the children are going to be equally behaved, so somebody has to be the worst. And if that child would leave the school, or then the next child, there was another worst child. So generally a materialistic person thinks, I'm going to adjust the world. I'm going to make a certain amount of money, have a certain kind of house, be with certain people, adjust the world so that I have no problems, and then I'm going to do what I want to do. Good luck with this. Yeah. Please let me know how this works out. It just doesn't work. You know, something is going to go wrong. You're going to have a problem with a husband or a mother-in-law or a child or a brother or a boss or a teacher or a student or a landlord or a neighbor, or a government, or somebody with a business you're dealing with. Somebody will cause you trouble. You'll have trouble with your body, you'll have trouble with your mind, things in your house will break. Am I correct?
Yes.
And if we're putting all of our energy into adjusting those things, and especially other people, if you're trying to fix other people, it's not very effective. I have a hard enough time fixing myself. I have things about myself I've been trying to fix my whole life, and they're still not fixed. And yet I think I can fix my husband and my children and my mother-in-law. I can't fix myself. They said someone getting angry at their children, you know. They don't want to get angry at their children. Oh, I got angry at my child. Okay, next time I'm not going to do that. And then they do it again. And then we think, well, I can't control my own anger and I'm going to fix my husband. It's ludicrous, actually. So our Krishna consciousness is not dependent on all these things. We might think it's easier to be Krishna conscious if I have a husband who's as serious about spiritual life as I am. Maybe. So being Krishna conscious is always a choice of our own mentality. Sometimes having someone in opposition makes it easier. You know, the sociological studies is that religious people are the most serious when they're being persecuted. This is just a historical fact. If people live in a country where they're free to practice their religion and there's no persecution, they tend to get lax. So in the spiritual world, Krishna sets up this yogamaya of opposition. He sets up a yogamaya of opposition for himself. The gopis have husbands who don't want them to see Krishna. Did you ever think about that? Husbands, fathers, brothers. And then Krishna appears to be young, unmarried. So Krishna's parents are in opposition. Krishna has to hide from his parents that he's going to dance with the gopis. And then the gopis' husbands are in opposition for Krishna. The gopis' mother-in-laws, sisters-in-law. Why in the spiritual world does Krishna create this yogamaya of opposition from family? And then among his queens, Rukmini's brother was in opposition. Uttravinda, her brothers were in opposition. Sometimes opposition can make us stronger. It's not that everything has to be... That's a boring story, actually. Nobody would watch a play or a movie or read a book where there was no opposition. It would be completely boring. Can you imagine that? Imagine, you know, some Bollywood movie. I love you, you love me, we get married, we live happily, end of story. Nobody would watch this. Am I correct? Is this boring?
Yeah.
What I found in these things is meditate on Krishna's Leela. So if you're having trouble with your husband, think, okay, in Krishna's Leela, in the Leelas of the devotees, who has trouble with a husband? And meditate on that. Not to think, oh, well, I guess my situation isn't so bad because it was there for somebody else. Not that way. But get into the mood of the Shastra. What was it really like for Gandhari to be married to Dhritarashtra? What did that feel like? What did she experience? She loved him. She loved her children, too. But it was really hard for her that Dhritarashtra was opposing the Pandavas and bringing on this war. It was hard. How did she feel? and start to go deep into her feelings, you'll forget about your problems with her. Because you'll start experiencing rasa from these pastimes. So we want to get absorbed in rasa. And we don't want to be absorbed in the false rasa of our own families. My husband, my children, my father-in-law, my brother. But use that as an impetus. What is there in the lila? Because our mind is going, oh, my husband, my husband. So, okay, what can I absorb my mind in Krishna's lila? And then everything becomes so sweet. And then you are already Krishna conscious. Then you're already Krishna. Your husband's watching the football game on television or whatever. But you're absorbed in thinking about the Mahabharata. Or the Ramayana. What about Mandodari's husband? Well, I'd like to have that for a husband, huh? Ravana for a husband. Please think about this for a minute. You know, you're married to Ravana, and you've already got to put up with the fact that he has, you know, thousands of other women. You've already got to deal with that. And then he kidnaps Sita. So you've got to deal with the fact that he loves Sita more than he loves you.
Yeah.
And that it's irreligious. That she doesn't want him. You know, maybe you've accepted that he has these other thousands of women who want him. But Sita doesn't want him. And you can see that your whole kingdom is going to be destroyed. As a chaste woman yourself, you understand that Sita has this power. She's going to destroy everything. And you can see your husband is heading headlong into disaster. And your brother-in-law, Babishan, is saying this. The rishis are saying this. You know, Marichi has said this. And you're having to watch your husband destroy himself and destroy the kingdom. How did she feel? I really wonder how Mandodari felt when she saw Sita reunited with Ram. Was she happy? I think she was happy. You know, after Ravana died, she says, your body is fit to be eaten by vultures and your soul is fit to go to hell. It's in the Bhagavatam. She got to be part of the pastimes of Ram. Even with a husband like Ravana. She saw that her husband's policies led to the death of her children. His ego, his policies. But she got to be part of the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra. So meditate on that. What was that? What's that like? Not to meditate on and say, well, at least my husband isn't robbing. I'm not saying like that. I'm saying that enter into the lila in your mind, in your heart. If you're going around all day thinking about the Ramayana, thinking about the Mahabharata, thinking about the Bhagavatam, then you're already Krishna conscious. And then if your husband wants to spend all day watching the football game, it won't bother you so much. You're going to be in ecstasy, absorbed in lila. When we have a downfall in Krishna consciousness, how can we lift ourselves back up in Krishna consciousness? Battling with material life at times is very difficult. I always give this example. I've given it hundreds of times. How do children learn how to walk? They just stand up again. They don't get mental about it. We all learned how to walk, yes? Everybody here knows how to walk? That means we already did this. We know how to do it. We did it. We've all seen children learn how to walk. First they stand up for 2 seconds, then what do? They fall down. Do they give up? Nah, I'm not going to learn how to walk, I'm useless. They don't do that. You know, they try it again and they get so excited. You know, they stand up. They don't get discouraged. If we got discouraged, we wouldn't be walking now, we'd still be crawling. We didn't get discouraged. We just kept getting back up. And sometimes we got bruises. Yes? They get bruises. And the parents, the aunties, the grandparents, they also don't criticize the child. Useless child keeps falling. Nobody criticizes. They take, today they'll take a video, you know, put it on Facebook, Instagram, whatever. Two steps! She took two steps, you know. There's nothing, two steps. Nobody says, whole day, they're crawling, they took two steps for 2 seconds, what is that, useless? Just get back up. Now, don't be mental. Oh, I fall down. Now I have to just stay down. If I get back up, I'll probably fall down again. Yeah, okay. And then you get back up again. Even now as adults, sometimes we fall. We don't give up on walking. I don't say I tripped over the steps and I fell down. Oh, now walking is finished for me. You know, come on, really. We don't have to be so hard on ourselves. Be kind. Please, be kind to ourselves. And eventually we'll be running. Bhagavatam says we will run, we'll be able to run with eyes closed even. We were little, we could only stand up for 2 seconds. And now we can run. And we don't even think about walking anymore. And the little child, when they first walk, they have to really concentrate, right? Mm-hmm. They can't even hold a toy at the same time. They have to just... And their walking is so awkward. I don't have to think about it anymore. I just walk. So it will be like that. Not worried. Please be kind to yourself. Ugh. Fell down. Okay. Back up. Will I fall down again? Probably. It's okay. I'm just going to keep getting back. Just say to Krishna, Krishna, I don't care how many times I struggle, I'm going to get back up each time. You can't say to Krishna, I will never have difficulty. That's not real. Even the great, great, great saintly persons have difficulty. Read about it in the Bhagavatam. Even the demigods have difficulty. Am I correct?
Yes.
How many stories are there? Many.
Yes.
So many. And you're like, that person had difficulty? We're so surprised. Really? Okay, just say Krishna, no matter how many times I fall, I'm going to keep getting back up. I'm going to keep getting back up, and I'm going to keep getting back up. That you can say to Krishna, I'm going to keep getting back up. If I get discouraged, I may cry for a little while, and then I'm going to get back up. And I'm going to try again, and I know I'm going to keep failing, but my failures will become less and less, and further apart, and eventually I'll be running. And I'll forget, just like we all have forgotten, how hard it was for us to learn to walk. We don't even remember anymore. Or to eat. The little babies, half the food is on their face, half the food is on the floor. We don't remember anymore. We just eat. It will become like that with our Krishna consciousness as well. This person is asking about how they cannot be attracted to the Brahmajyoti.
You're walking with the time.
What?
You're walking with the time.
Oh, I don't know what time it is. Oof, I can't. Okay, just... I'll do this fast and then we'll go. How do we reconcile the qualities and behaviors of a traditional Vedic woman with Kali Yuga's situation of everyone being ready to take advantage, tolerant, etc.? How do we become selfless, tolerant, etc. for the family while being in tune with feminism and empowerment? Wow. All right, well, I also have a seminar on this, because it's getting late. It's on ISKCON Desire Tree, where I talk about the social and economic position of women in Vedic times. I think we have a lot of very strange misconceptions of Vedic women. of most of our conceptions of Vedic women come from concepts of an industrialized society. An industrialized society took away women's careers. Industrialization forced women to choose between careers and home, because in industrialized society, you have to leave home to go to work. In a traditional society, women had careers from the home. And one of the main reasons why in traditional society the husband and wife should be of the same varna was so the service to the husband also involved service in the career. If your husband was a teacher and you were a teacher, part of serving your husband was to help your husband run his school. If your husband was the king and you were the queen, part of serving your husband was to help run the kingdom. Draupadi said that she managed the whole treasury. She said, I'm the only one who knows what is the income and expenditure of the kingdom. And I'm running the royal palace of 100,000 people. That's a city. Prabhupada said, ideal family, the wife is spinning, the husband is weaving, together they make a cloth. The young gopis, they were crossing the Yamuna to sell their milk and butter in Mathura because they were businesswomen. They weren't simply domestic servants. The idea that every woman to be a Vedic wife has to be simply a domestic servant is a result of the Industrial Revolution. It's not a traditional society. In a traditional society, women had varna. Varna means... Krishna says, guna karma vibhagasha. Guna and karma. Everybody agrees that women have varna? If someone's Indian and they don't think women have varna, then I don't know where they've been living. And in the scripture, women have varna, yes? And what does Krishna say? Chatur varna mayashvastam, guna karma vibhagasha. That means that we women also have a certain quality of a certain varna. And if we have that quality, we have a certain work. But that doesn't mean we go out and have a career and wear high-heeled shoes and short dresses and flirt with the men at work and then our husband has to eat, you know, food from the restaurant. We had that varna at home. But most men had their varna at home also. People didn't go to work, generally. And then there was extended family. So it's not that one woman had to do all the cooking and all the cleaning and all the childcare. I think a lot of our views of the Vedic women are strange. And read the Mahabharata and the Ramayana and the Bhagavatam. And start to pay attention. What are the women doing? When Vamadeva arrested Bali Maharaj, his wife came into the assembly. They're not all mice. It's not that these Vedic women are all less like. You weren't like that, Draupadi was not like that. Was Draupadi like that? Not at all. Even you think Mother Yasoda, she wasn't. As far as being tolerant and patient, everybody should be tolerant and patient. If you're really empowered, be empowered with Krishna Shakti. And then we'll be tolerant and patient. As far as feminism, the strictly dictionary definition of feminism is simply that women also have human rights. So by that dictionary definition of feminism, I would hope that everybody is a feminist. I hope that everybody believes that women should have basic human rights. If by feminism we mean that men and women are the same, then, you know, I have to question your one's sanity. Got different bodies and somewhat different psychologies. So that to me is just like common sense. But that everybody should have a life of dignity and respect. I mean, if someone says, oh, a certain class of people shouldn't be treated with dignity and respect. That's a problem spiritually. Okay, how to help kids in practicing Krishna consciousness. Again, I'm sorry, in the interest of time, I have these three seminars online. Four keys, parenting according to the Gita, and Prabhupada's principles of Gurukul. So I refer you to those. How one can make family members favorable to Krishna consciousness if they are all non-devotees and doesn't have faith in Krishna consciousness. Become so such a wonderful and happy person that they look at you and say, I'd like to be like you. Don't go around criticizing them all the time. And they may not. You know, they have free will. We have this word make. How can one make family members favorable? I don't think you can make anybody anything. Again, I haven't learned how to force myself to do things. I don't think it works. I don't think forcing myself or forcing others. Temporarily. A very short term. Force is okay. But generally, long term, it doesn't work. If you even try to force yourself long term, you'll actually make yourself sick. Which tells me that it's not the will of God to be forcing yourself. It's just like, I know I'm not supposed to walk through the wall because it hurts. So if I force myself, it hurts. Like, oh, that must be a wall. I'm not supposed to do that. Again, a little bit of force with ourselves is useful sometimes, but not as a general policy. So don't try to make other people be Krishna conscious. You can't. It's just not how it works. You can try to inspire other people to be Krishna conscious. And it may work and it may not work. That's not your problem. You can say, you know, and are you doing it for them or for you? Are you doing it because it would be more pleasant to be with a family that was Krishna conscious? But again, that's not... There's some happiness in being with opposition. There must be, or Krishna wouldn't do it. There's got to be some happiness with having opposition. Krishna finds happiness in having... He creates an illusion of opposition for his own happiness. Just imagine. Everyone in the spiritual world is favorable to Krishna. Nobody is opposed. But it looks like Jatila is opposed. And even different groups of gopis seem to oppose each other. And they do that to make Krishna happy. So you could also find, how can I find happiness in opposition? How can it add some interest to my life? But you can always try to inspire people, and sometimes it works. Sometimes it works too well, and your family members will become more serious than you. I've seen this happen. I remember with one couple, husband was not interested at all. And the wife was just patient and just, you know, after 2 years, he was even not vegetarian. After 2 years, he said, I don't know what you're doing, but whatever it is, I want it. You know, you're so happy, you're so peaceful, I want it. And he became a much more serious devotee than she was. And then it was a little awkward for her. She's like, I hadn't known I wanted you to become that serious. But I've seen it many times. You know, many, many times. I've seen children inspire their parents. Yeah. You know, I've seen it. And you see the other sometimes. It just doesn't work. But over time, I mean, I'm thinking, I left my family to live in the temple ashram. It took my mother 8 years to stop being very opposed. For the first 8 years, I was practicing Krishna consciousness. She was very, very opposed. And for 2 more years, she was somewhat opposed. And then she became neutral. And then gradually she became favorable. And the main thing that made her favorable was when our children started growing up. And she said, you must be doing something good to have such nice children. The other thing that softened her, interestingly enough, was my sister. Because I had been raised in a Jewish home. And my mother always said, if you want to be super religious, why don't you become a super religious Jew? Why do you have to take another religion? Mm. So one of my sisters became a super religious Jew. And then she became very critical of my mother for not being religious enough. My sister became kind of fanatic. She married a rabbi, and my mother would tell me this. I mean, my sister stopped talking to me completely until just after when she knew she was dying, then she saw me. When she was diagnosed with cancer, she saw me once, and then 3 weeks before she died, she saw me again. But otherwise, she would not talk to me at all. And my mother told me, she said, "I'm not welcome at your sister's house, because," she says, "I do not want my daughter to see that a Jewish woman will wear pants." So I don't want you in my house. You're a bad example for my daughter. So my mother, when she saw my sister doing this, she said, "I'm so grateful you're not a religious Jew." She said, "You are more accepting of me." And when my mother died, she was very Krishna conscious. Like in the last week of her life, she became very open. She had a very, very auspicious death. But for 8 years, it was not pleasant at all. I didn't even want to talk to her. I said it was really unpleasant. All she would do was criticize, and very heavy. You know, it was really bad. I remember one time she was visiting us, and my husband said, "Maybe you shouldn't come to our house anymore." And she said, "Why not?" He said, "Because you want my wife to leave Krishna consciousness and leave her husband, leave her son." And she said, "No one wants her to leave her son." That was hard. It was definitely hard. So sometimes people change, and sometimes they don't.
May I ask one question?
My main question is, can I get back and go to sleep?
How you came across with the Prabhupada?
Another time. If you want to know how I came to Krishna consciousness, so you can go on my personal blog, which is onuladasi.com, and under unpublished essays, okay. I have an essay there, how I came to Krishna consciousness. If you want to know my Prabhupada stories, that's somewhere on Iskand Desire Tree. That's recording. How I came to Krishna consciousness. I've written that up as an essay online. Is that all right? I hope this was helpful.
Yes.
Too much. Oh, okay. Next time I'll be less helpful. Hare Krishna.